No fear. No fear. No fear here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona, from the BEA beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com. Lawrence Reed from Fee. Okay, I'm gonna read to you a little bit of his bio. We don't want to go, you know, too long, because, man, it's like a lot of accolades for Lawrence. Let's go ahead and just give you kind of what for. Lawrence W. Larry Reed became, I call him Lawrence, became president of Fee in 2008. After serving as chairman of its board of trustees in the 1990s and both writing and speaking for Fee since the late 1970s, prior to becoming Fee's president, he served for 20 years as president of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy in Midland, Michigan. He also taught economics full-time from 77 to 84 at Northwood University. Now, this is a foundation for economic education. Okay, which economic education? You know, which we're going to find out. And chaired its Michigan's Department of Economics from 82 to 84. He holds a BA degree in economics from Grove City College and an MA degree in history from Slippery Rock State University, both in Pennsylvania. He holds two honorary doctorates, one from Central Michigan University and Northwood University. He's got, like, you know, degrees. A champion for liberty, Reed has authored over 1,000 newspaper columns and articles, dozens of articles in magazines, and lists them all. It goes on and on and on. But at first, what I want to start off with is say hello to Lawrence and hear, as a young man, how he first came to experience the power of Fee. You know, Lawrence, tell us that story, will you please? Welcome to the show.
Okay. I'd be happy to, Ernie. And thanks, by the way, for having me on your show.
Pleasure.
I first got involved with Fee way back in the 1960s. It was in 1968 that, because of a Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, I got involved with a group called Young Americans for Freedom. And one of the first things that that organization did at that time was to give every new member a copy of The Freeman, which is the magazine that we publish at Fee and have since the 1950s. And also a lot of books from Fee. So I first became acquainted at the age of 14, and then later in the 1970s, I began writing for the Freeman, and then later speaking for Fee, and later served on its board, and am now president. So you might say I've sort of worked my way up from stock clerk to the position of president of Fee, which is a great honor. And people who listen to your show can find out a lot more about us by visiting our website at fee.org.
Okay, thank you for that. The one thing that I really wanted to ask you is, when you first, I guess you took a trip to Washington or something, they were out passing out stuff. You know, where were you at that they were passing out? How were they passing it out? They had girls in bikinis, you know, or old guys, you know, in walkers? I mean, what was going on? How did you get your first exposure to Fee?
Well, if you recall, in August of 1968, the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia, and I was just incensed by that. And within a matter of days, I saw in my little local newspaper, the Beaver Falls News Tribune in western Pennsylvania, that there was a group, Young Americans for Freedom, that was going to have a demonstration against the Soviet invasion in Pittsburgh, about 30 miles away. So I got a bus ticket, went up to Pittsburgh, joined in on the demonstration, and then joined YAF because of that. So I sort of got involved in the freedom movement from an anti-communist angle, motivated by a reaction to the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968. But it was YAF that connected me with Fee, and Fee has been just so central to my life ever since.
Okay, how old were you when this happened? 68?
14.
Okay, at 14, and you're just, ooh, them damn Soviets going to get some Ruskies and so on. Kind of, where did that come from?
Well, you know, I've often analyzed that, and quite some time ago, I came to the conclusion that what really motivated that interest was the movie, The Sound of Music, which I saw first in 1966 in Pittsburgh. I didn't want to go. My mother said, look, you're going to go. I want you to see this movie. It's a true story. And, of course, the setting was Austria, not Czechoslovakia, but to me at that time, it was, they were sort of next door to each other. That was a story of oppression from the Nazi regime against Austria. But that's what gave me, at the age of 12, a keen interest in current events and in history and in pre-World War II events in Europe in particular. So when the events of Czechoslovakia began to unfold in 1968, I sort of had a natural interest in that based upon the stimulation I got from that great movie, The Sound of Music, in 1966.
No, the Von Trapp, or Trapp, or whatever family. Von Trapp. Yeah, I remember that. And at the end, you know, the Nazi youth guy, whether he's going to rat on him or not. There's a lot of subtext in that. And I'm just wondering, you know, Czechoslovakia gets invaded by the Russians. There had to have been, to bring it to such an import to you, the newsreels at the time, the news, you know, Walter Cronkite. Oh, they did. They're next door. Here it comes tomorrow, New Jersey. And I'm just, you know, and then, of course, we're right, you know, peeking. You know, the Tet Offensive was right out at that time. And you have Vietnam going on and all this. I mean, has your understanding of who to blame and what was behind has evolved with age? Do you start to see it more for what it was?
Yeah, I think with time, that's the nature of progress in thinking. You learn more and you begin to assign responsibility appropriately. You recall that in The Sound of Music, the Nazi regime was oppressing Austria. It annexed the country in 1938, and in the movie it focuses on the family whose patriarch is drafted by the Hitler regime. And so I saw that as, wow, you know, why doesn't that nasty regime leave these people alone? And I realized, I think for the first time in my young life, that people around the world don't live quite as freely as we do here in America. So then when I saw the Soviet Union oppressing Czechoslovakia and invading it in 1968, it was a natural connection for me to make between what I learned in that movie and subsequent reading and then the events of the Soviet invasion. But you're right, that was a very incredible decade. Lots of upheavals and revolutions, and you know, it was
amazing to me. Bad. Under all that war, all that oppression, all that threat, all of that, you know, red versus, and for some reason, you're drawn to an organization that provided you information about economics. So I'm just wondering what the tie-in with economics and the education that they were doing with all these other news items that occupied your mind.
Well, with the material that was given to me when I joined Young Americans for Freedom, much of which was coming from FEE, it became apparent to me that the message was, if you want to be an anti-communist, it's not enough to simply oppose tanks in the streets and blunt physical oppression against people. You've also got to know your philosophy and your economics, because these systems, communism in particular, they all have philosophical presuppositions.
We rule you! We're in charge!
Yeah, that's right. So the more I read, the more I understood that, communism comes from a set of very harmful ideas.
You know, when we come back, you know, this is the harmful ideas. We start getting into economics. It's just the manifestation of this philosophy is, oh, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to do that, or you have to do that. It's we rule you. Really, no one, those that won't leave us alone, that's it. They just want to be left alone. They won't do it. When we come back, we're going to talk about the minimum wage, how that applies.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world?
Yes, I am. Okay, this is a good segue into that, and the minimum wage is a manifestation of you know, this philosophy that we're dealing with. And yeah. I did you watch the State of the Union?
No, I'm sorry, I couldn't quite bring myself to do
I know
that.
Me neither. I go like this. The closest I came to it was, well, we had you know, the last few minutes of Ron Paul's response, you know, the State of the Liberty or something in 2015. So a couple of days ago, I put up just the last few minutes, and Ron goes, "Violence alone is not going to fix this. You got to know what you're doing, and then you go kick their butt." And I'm going, okay, you know, because I remember at a, it was Era Society, one of Doug Casey's things in Aspen, just a few weeks before 9/11. Mark Victor and I went up there. It was like 6 weeks before our Freedom Summit. So we just wanted to see how they did it, you know, and kind of give us some inspiration how we organized. We had already planned. It was on the books. Then 3 weeks later, 9/11. Then 3 weeks after that was the Freedom Summit. And we had like Bumper Hornberger and Vince Cernowitz and Butler Schaefer and Bob Levy and Don Brudeau. I mean, it was a, I mean, to have it right after 9/11 with that crowd, you're going, ow, we got, yeah. We could see what was coming. Well, yeah. Great discussion there. And we went to great pains to, you know, use that newfangled internet thing to get a, you know, discussion up between Bumper Hornberger and Vince Cernowitz. And I remember that Sunday, Butler Schaefer came down. He goes, well, they just started bombing Afghanistan. And we're all going, you know, here we go. Well, that's why we did the summit, was to warn our friends what was happening. And you kind of got how it works. I mean, you've spoken at a summit before. So I'm just going, okay, when that happened, and we had got to go to Casey's Air Society thing. Ron Paul was there giving a presentation that was, you know, Ron Paul, you know, government sucks, yep, and Washington's corrupt and it's the Federal Reserve stupid, you know, that kind of thing. So as he gave his presentation, I asked him, his first time I'd actually, you know, physically met Ron, and he's spoken at three of the summits since then. But I go, Ron, so what are you saying? You know, public, we're at the mic and questioned, and Mark and I go, okay, so there's a solution here. Are you building up? Is there something we should be doing? And he goes, buy a gun. I go, you the man. I go, okay, I get it, man. It's that bad? Okay.
Ron's a great man and a patriot, that's for sure.
Well, when he did his response to the State of the Union, he was talking about, hey, man, you know, violence is not going to fix this. It may be a necessary component, but, you know, that's not what the, it's more the fee thing and the education that, you know, that this needs to happen first so you know what the hell you're fighting for, or all of a sudden now you got new guys with guns, you know, standing at the podium. I mean, you know, big freaking difference. So there, it's coming. It's getting fat. It's coming at a faster clip. And those of us, you know, especially someone such as you that's influenced from the 60s by this, you can see, man, we're like one day closer to whatever the heck is coming. So the minimum wage, I don't know if that'll segue into what all this kind of boots on the ground and here it comes and the drone army is going to get us here. But it belies the philosophy behind it, of which that is inevitable. You know, so so I want to talk about, you know, the minimum wage, you know, go off wherever we go off. But let's go ahead and do your article.
Okay.
Okay. Is there any other issues of news today you want to bring up?
No, but if you want a couple minutes on, you know, what fee is and does, that'd be great, too. I'd love to tell people about.
Yeah.
What
no.
We do
first, chance, it'll, we'll get an opportunity. We'll get that in there. You know.
Okay.
Here we go.
While our satellite channel is free to listen to, it's not free for us. You can help us cover our satellite costs with the chip-in on the right side of the page at lrn.fm.
To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800. 602-264-2800. And now, Ernest Hancock.
For economic education. We need some education. I tell you the one thing that, you know, prompted, gave me a good excuse, like I needed any to have Lawrence come on the show, was his article on the minimum wage. This has been a big issue for a long time, and it kind of surprises a lot of people when libertarian-oriented individuals will come up and they'll say, minimum wage has caused job loss. You know, I have my own stories, you know. I mean, a lot of time I have a restaurant, you know, young kids come in, we're building it, constructing it, doing tenant improvement, and little kids come in, hey, man, I want a job I can do. I go, absolutely. Here, sweep here. Hey, well, are you sure you got, you know, isn't there some form you got to fill out? Kind of, I go, here's $5 for an hour. You just cleaned up all the crap. I didn't have to do it. Done. We're good. And from then on, they're always, hey, I got a job. When we open, I couldn't hire them. They weren't worth, you know, the minimum wage, really, to do anything. They were underage. But I could, you know, definitely. So I had little jobs that, you know, they could do and stuff. But it was illegal. And it took away the, for a lot of other young kids going to the local general store, if you have to give them a minimum wage, it takes that first rung on the ladder to learn anything. And what if you just want to be an apprentice? What if you want to go work for nothing? Oh, hell, you're going to pay me a dollar an hour for me to get here and get an education, learn something? This minimum wage thing is bad, is bad, is bad. And Lawrence, you're going to tell us all about, why is it bad?
Well, you know, Henry Hazlitt was a great economist, long associated with our organization. He wrote a column for Newsweek for many years, and he put it so well when he said that you cannot make a person worth a certain amount by making it illegal to pay him any less. In other words, in fact, an even better way to put it is to ask the question, is there such a thing as a job or a person who may only be worth to an employer, say, $5 an hour? Well, of course, not everybody's worth, and not every job is automatically worth what Congress happens to arbitrarily decree. I mean, I can think of things I might pay somebody to do if I could pay them only $4 or $5 an hour, because that's all the job is worth. It doesn't require much skill. But if the law tells me I have to pay at least $7 or $8, what that simply does is it forces into unemployment the very people I might have given a job to, the first rung on the economic ladder. And I'm certainly, as a business person, not going to say, this person or this job is only worth $5 an hour to me, but I'll happily pay him $7 or $8 and incur the loss just to be a nice guy. I mean, who does that? Not even the statists and the progressives who advocate for the minimum wage ever do that in their own personal business lives.
You know, a lot of times they'll do things like, we provide more health care, this, it's a PR thing, we provide this, a minimum wage, we provide a living, what we provide while we get a bunch of robots to replace half our workforce. So I'm going, this is this demand or requirement for all these different benefits and costs, all of a sudden, in Washington State, Oregon, wherever they're doing that, you know, here comes the McDonald's attendant that's a robot. I mean, this is going to, do you think unemployment, I mean, just from that alone, automation, robots, and so on, because they've made it so expensive to provide jobs for someone that they're just go, I silicon and aluminum and I'm good. Next.
Yeah. Well, I can give you another example. It's not one of automation, but your point is well taken. But for one of my first jobs years and years ago when I was in high school, was to work as an usher at a theater. And, you know, that doesn't take much work. You just stand there, rip a ticket in half, and, you know, turn the lights on and off, that sort of thing. And I was happy to get a start. But today, have you ever noticed how many ushers there are in theaters? That's been basically priced out of the labor market.
And that was the first job of a lot of people. As a kid, I mean, it's gotten so bad. I mean, the iconic lemonade stand, you got to get your permit. And yeah. If that doesn't really emphasize the problem. And it's why, you know, a lot of fee supporters and libertarians and anarchists and whatever, yep, we're going to have a lemonade stand and film the arrest because they know it's coming. And I'm going, this is the kind of education that I think the minimum wage, is that one of your lead issues, or is there on education of economics and how it works? Are there some others that you use? I mean, that's a good one, but give me some others.
Yeah. Well, that one certainly comes up a lot. We want our students who come to our seminars, and they do that by the thousands all over the country, all during the course of the year. We want them to understand that prices, and really wages, are a kind of price. They don't just arise without rhyme or reason. They're not random. When you try to rig them, when you, by law, try to force them up or down, you have consequences. I like to ask audiences this question. If the minimum wage really makes sense, if it really helps people, then why do you settle for a mere $7 or $8 or $9 or even $15? Why not just pass a law forcing every employer to pay $50 an hour?
Quiet. You're giving them ideas. You're giving them ideas.
Yeah. Well, you know, another way to look at that is a law that says an employer must pay a certain amount is like telling would-be employees, unless you can find a job that pays at least $7, $8, $9, whatever it may be, at least unless you can find a job that pays that, you're not allowed to work.
No, that's exactly what they're saying. That's exactly what's going on. If you can't find a job worth that or be worth that, you don't get to. You better start, you know, dealing some drugs. Okay?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. So what progress are you making in, you know, there's two places. There's public opinion, there's people, culture, general, kind of, we get it. And then there's, of course, you know, the legislators. And the legislators, who's arguing for, and what basis are they doing for them to increase the minimum wage? I mean, we got, that was part of the State of the Union that neither of us watched.
Yeah. You know? Certainly, FEE, my organization, is never in Washington making the case for it. But I can tell you that among the people who do, the ones who go to Washington and argue for a hike in the minimum wage, are several categories of people. One are the well-meaning but economically uninformed, who simply think that by decree, by just passing a law, you can somehow magically increase people's income, who don't understand economics well enough to see all sides of the issue. But then you've also got some not so well-meaning people. Some of those are businesses that are already paying higher than the minimum wage to get and keep the kind of employees that they want. But they figure, hey, if I can get the government to force wages up, well, that'll take care of some of my smaller newcomer competitors who are trying to get started in the same business I'm in, and they've got an advantage by not having to pay quite as much as I do, and the law will put them out of business.
Well, that just means that they go to China or Taiwan or Singapore or Philippines and India and Pakistan. Sure. They're guaranteeing the shipping out of the jobs.
Sure. And then you've got labor unions, too, that often go to Washington and say force it up for the same reason, because they don't want lower cost competition.
Oh. See, if you learn economics, you can figure this stuff out. We'll be right back here on Declare Your Independence with Lawrence Reed from the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE.org. We'll be right back.
This is Donna Hancock with Brangus Realty in Arizona. Now more than ever, we have to seek out good investments to help secure our future. The real estate market across the country today seems to have recovered. Inventories are low, housing prices have gone up over the past year, and money is available to lend. But you must be careful to read between the lines of what the mainstream news is reporting. There is a shadow inventory, and the market is manipulated by a multiple number of factors. And we will need to anticipate this flux and prepare for the next market downturn in housing. There are many communities across the country today that have a growing mindset of preparing to ride out the financial storm. And Arizona is one of those places. If you are interested in moving to the desert southwest, where we have 3 to 4 growing seasons a year, and the sun is readily available for anything solar, I will be here to help you when that time comes. Feel free to use my webpage at donnahancock.com to search for Arizona properties that are of interest to you. And please, feel free to call me at 602-828-1819 to discuss options for your move to Arizona.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Who grew up tall and proud in the shadow of the mushroom cloud? Which now voices can be heard? Just want to scream louder and louder. What the hell are we fighting for?
Yeah! Here on Declare Your Independence, I'm Ernest Hancock. How about that? The truth, justice, American way, whatever. That welled up in the chest of Lawrence Reed in 1968. The Ruskies invade Czechoslovakia and made it very clear that we just freaking rule you. They're behind the Iron Curtain of Berlin Wall's of, and we got ICBMs and Sputnik and war, and the dominoes are going to fall across Southeast Asia. We got it. The future doesn't look too bright. You know, it's right after, a few years after Cuban Missile Crisis. We had, you know, JFK killed, Martin Luther King. We have Robert Kennedy. I mean, all this stuff is going on right then in the mind of a 14-year-old, and it comes down to minimum wage is bad. I mean, it represents so much stuff. And I want to make sure, you know, you understand what Lawrence brings to this is a perspective, an education, an understanding. And the minimum wage being an issue, how much pushback do you get on that from other organizations or people? Do they even attempt to argue with you, Lawrence?
Oh, yeah. It's one of those things that inspires a lot. a lot of emotion, a lot of knee-jerk thinking. You know, often when you make a case against it, the first thing you hear is, well, but a person can't get by, especially if he has a family, on a mere $7 an hour. But again, you know, what employer can pay more than what a job is worth and happily eat the difference just because the worker would like to have more? I mean, ultimately, that's not the way you and I as consumers behave. When we go into a business, we don't say, oh, I don't think you're charging me enough. I'd like to help you out more, so I'll happily add more and eat the difference. We don't pay. We're always looking for the best buy. Well, that's exactly what employers do. So quite often with the minimum wage, what happens is that the newcomer in the labor market, or one with little education or few skills, the very people that the advocates of the minimum wage say they want to help, they're the ones who get hurt. They're the ones who are denied the beginning opportunities in the labor market that would allow them to develop skills, build references, and get what they need to move on and earn more as they build their careers.
See, this has to be understood by, you know, just business in general and culture and so on. But it seemed to me that government's always used to eliminate competition in whatever form. And that's the, you know, people that get politicians to do what they want, they're not stupid. They may be evil, but they're not stupid. You know, they're going, look, man, we need to have this, this, and this to protect our interest of. And so that's what they lobby for and have the resources for. So I'm wondering, one simple thing when I campaign and so on, and it's a matter of fact, you'd be interested in this. A couple of years ago, I debated the president of the teachers union, and it was a progressive radio station wanted me to come in a big auditorium. We're going to have us a discussion. Let's make fun of the libertarians. OK, and I knew it was coming. I'm going, you guys really think, OK, I mean, you guys think you want me to go. So the thing was, is that we're talking with the unions about minimum wage and having the ability to compete and all that. And the one point that I always like bringing up is that it's the elimination of competition. They want you to have a high entry level to compete. They want you to have to go through all the rules and regulations and stuff that they created to protect them because they're large enough to absorb those costs and some lawyers and lobbyists and all this other stuff that they get to eliminate competition. And if you're really for the individual, you don't just take a government and say, pay him more, you allow him to start his own company. Here we had stories just in the last couple of weeks of engineers and stuff at Google are dissatisfied, not because they don't like their job or whatever. They just reached a plateau and they're smart enough to compete. Well, what's going to happen? They're going to do everything non-compete. They're going to do everything they can to suppress it, where Google probably be better off if they just spin off. Everybody's got a good idea. You know, how much can we front you and give us, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60, 90% of your company or something? I mean, you know, so it's just a philosophy that everybody's bucking, and if they embraced it, it would be so much better, freer, but why isn't it done?
What you've just described, Ernie, at least in the early part of what you just had to say, are what I call state worshipers. These are people, sometimes well-meaning, but these are people whose first priority is to have the government in charge, and they're not all that swayed by things like facts or evidence or logic, experience, history, reason. You know, the important thing to them is that government has to be in charge because government has a monopoly on compassion. And they don't see government, as we libertarians do, as a monopoly on force. That's the way our founders of this country saw government. That's why they, one among many reasons why they wanted to keep it small, because they realized that government, by its very definition, is a monopoly on legalized force. But this is the way a lot of people are conditioned to think because they've been taught for 12 years by government schools, and then they go on to a government university in many cases. And a lot of the folks in those places, you know, their livelihoods come from government, and so they want government to get bigger. Surprise, surprise.
It's amazing that you're as effective as you, that the libertarian, leave-me-aloneist, Austrian, whatever, survives at all. I mean, there's so much resources going in to turn human beings into a battery that I'm wondering how you are as successful as you are. And how do you gauge your success?
By my success, you mean fees?
Yeah, I mean, you know, having the education out there that you still exist. I mean, that people are giving you money, yeah. That people are learning stuff. I mean, how much of a penetration into this discussion are you being effective in turning minds? I mean, are you? It's an uphill battle, but are you making any progress?
Oh, yes, we are, and it's growing in terms of its scope and its impact every day. We are a rapidly growing organization, increasingly more and more effective. Our focus is on young people between the ages of roughly 14 to 24. And among those people, when you have an opportunity to tell them things like, hey, you're going to inherit a monumental debt burden from politicians and their supporters who thought nothing of getting something in the moment and sending you the bill for it. These young people then begin to think, hey, that's not the way to live, and I don't want to support that kind of thing. And young people are interested in things like creativity and adding value, productivity, starting businesses, and they don't like somebody from on high, 2,000 or 3,000 miles away, telling them every jot and tittle about how to do that, especially when they've never achieved it themselves. So we are making great progress, but it's a learning struggle. It's an educational struggle, and we have to open people's minds, give them inspiration and information so that they see the world in ways that they've never previously been taught to see it.
Okay.
And that's what we're getting better and better at fee all the time.
Okay. Now, the a lot of benefit came from, you know, Ron Paul's run, the Levolution and all that, I'm sure. Here we're going into 16. It's going to be, you know, Rand Paul. Do you guys advocate in voting? We got to go out there and support, you know, somebody for something. Is that where the solution is? Or you use that as a backdrop to forward that? I mean, how are you going to use the 2016 election cycle?
Fee is a 501c3 charitable entity, educational in nature, and by the IRS rules for such nonprofits, we cannot get involved in campaigns and candidacies and parties.
Yeah, but you can make fun of them.
We don't think that's... Well, yeah, we can talk about them. We can talk about their proposals, and ultimately, they reflect the general state of opinion, so you've got to work on the opinion. If all you do is work on the politicians, it's sort of like locking the barn door after the horse has left. We're doing something far more fundamental by focusing on ideas and, more narrowly, on newcomers, young people. Because when you make an investment in a young person, you're making an investment that can pay off for the next 50, 60, 70 years.
Yes. And what do we want to tell them? That they should...
We want to tell them that liberty and personal character and private property and small government... the way to go. That's basically the top of our message.
Small government? Can you advocate for none? I vote none! I got to vote. Okay, I vote none! Well, we'll talk about that. Voting? We'll talk about it. Okay. We're going to do the voting thing. So I'm just like, okay. These guys coming in, kind of, they should and look for, and they do or not or whatever. Because
yeah.
I can see, I've been covering... I had a really good opportunity as a young activist to see the explosion of technology and the, because I remember Pong. I go, look, ooh, you know, like a computer controls interactive on my screen, ain't that cool? But then you as a, you know, 7, 8, 9-year-old kid, I'm seeing man walk on the moon. I see Star Trek. I see, you know, then here I'm in high school and all of a sudden here comes Star Wars, the new Star Trek movies. And man, I am freaking inspired. And I'll tell you, I don't have my Jetson car because of government. Okay? I'm like, where's my flying freaking car? Well, then everybody starts sending me pictures of them. But, you know, the point is that I'm going, this, the world that I had imagined in my head, and there was no reason why we should not be beneficiaries of this enormous technology and time-freeing abundance of possibilities for an entire planet. And there is a philosophy, a something, a control that squashes that entire thing. And for me to dance with the devil, you don't change him. And I'm just like this politicking thing. I want to get your, you know, fees, you know, the next generation. Okay, therefore we must vote or not vote or vote in a certain way or it doesn't matter or it's not on the table.
I'd be happy to address that. I have some views on that, absolutely.
Okay, so that's why I want to prep that so that when we come back, we get that in the last thing here. Because I think, you know, the minimum wage just represents the manifestation of control. And we're here to represent the people. Now, of course, you know, the business, they want to come out like it benefits them, but, you know, people. But it's really for their own self-interest that they're advocating for this. It's all about eliminating competition and maintaining monopolies of we can and you can't. You know, as soon as that starts to penetrate, which I think it is to a lot of people, these young guys, I've been really lucky that I have seen this rebirth of things like blockchain technology and satellite and cheap manufacturing and 3D printing and, space travel. And I mean, it's really starting to get into the hands of the people and the crowdsource funding of Kickstarter and I do whatever. And I'm going, this is the world that I anticipated. And the only thing government is doing is to try and squash that. Or control, or get their cut. And it's so obvious what the benefits of leave me aloneist is so much more than a political scheme. And just choosing rulers is not, I'm like, ew, you know? So I'm wondering in the economics of the education coming from your foundation is like, if you vote right, you know what I mean?
I'm ready on that whenever you are.
All right. Well, I'm not going to have to talk then. I just want you to understand the perspective. I'll do like a 10-second and throw it to you and monologue me, man.
Okay.
All right, here we go.
Listen to LRN.FM on any phone, anytime. 213-493-0309. That's 213-493-0309.
Rhodes? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Vote myself free. I want to go vote. You're still voting? What were you getting for that? You know, you're doing what? I need to know the efficacy of voting, if it's something that's on there, and economics of that we should or shouldn't, and kind of in which candidate. And I'm not watching the State of the Union because I can't bring myself to do it. Lawrence Reed, help from Fee, going to help us out. This voting thing, you know, as we got this next generation that came in going after a couple of presidential election cycles, and you get one more, you know, what we got here? We got this is good. This is the first time that we're going to be calling the presidential candidates by their first name. It's going to have to be which Bush, which Clinton, which Paul. Should it be, you know, Hillary, Jeb, and Rand. I mean, seriously, the legacies of the, it's so comical. It's getting to the point to where, I mean, come on, you got it's like South Park, vote or die, vote or die. So anyway, so go ahead, you know, help me out here. The voting thing, is that addressed at all by Fee? You know, explain that to us.
Okay, well, Fee does not itself have an institutional view on voting. I can certainly tell you what my personal view is. The fact is that I vote sometimes, I don't vote other times, and when I do vote, there are some places on the ballot that I leave completely blank. And this is because I have high standards, and that's what I would hope everybody would have. Don't go to vote just for the sake of voting. In fact, if somebody does not know what's at stake, doesn't understand the issues, doesn't even know anything about the candidates, well, by all means, stay home. Don't vote. Get educated. And even then, I hope you don't go to the polls to vote because you're trying to claim through the political process a portion of somebody else's earnings. There are an awful lot of people who vote for that reason, because they're using government to get something at other people's expense. Instead of working for a living, they're voting for one. And I can tell you, though, that I'm not a non-voter consistently. If I had been around in 1800, I know I would have voted for Thomas Jefferson to unseat John Adams. I know I would have voted for Grover Cleveland when he ran in 1884, 88, and 92. Every now and then you get a pretty good candidate who understands liberty. But I also respect the non-voter. If somebody says, look, I'm not going to vote because I think the candidates are nothing more than Machine Gun Kelly and Scarface, and it's just a matter of who's going to loot me. I can understand that, so I don't condemn the non-voter. In fact, I encourage politicians to pay heed to the non-voter, to ask, why is it that I wasn't able, as a politician, to rise to the standards that people have that might have encouraged them to vote? Instead, we blame the non-voter, but too often we ought to blame the choices that are put before them.
I tell you what, my vote was not voting. You can count me.
And
that count is accurate. Yeah, I go, yep, I did not go. You know, and sometimes it's not. You wind up voting whether you voted or not. So this is one thing that has been a big thing for me. I ran for Secretary of State in 94 and 06. You know, my signs in 06 are like, you're still voting? You know, the V for Vendetta and the voting thing. And I'm going, this is the point that I was making and continued to, is that until you can convince me it's even accurate, the results don't even matter. I mean, I really...
Voting is fraught with all kinds of problems. Unlike the marketplace, where you get what you pay for and you pay for what you get almost all of the time, when you go into the voting booth, you're voting for a bundle of something, some of which you like, a lot of which you don't. And that's all the more reason, one of many, to keep government small in the first place, because it's rooted in legalized coercion, and your choices are not optimal. You don't always get what you voted for. Quite often you don't. And so there are lots of reasons to keep it small and keep it out of your life. Not, a lot of things should never be subject to vote.
Yeah, that was kind of the promise. See, one thing that I think is of great interest is this blockchain technology allows for a lot of things. There is a company, a guy named Paul Snow has a company called Factum that they are working with the governments in Central America, and there's one in particular, and they won't say, but I'm pretty sure it's Honduras, that they're trying to create a multi-signature, it's not for sure and for certain, this is your property, and they didn't pay $5,000 to somebody to change the whatever, and it's not anymore, you know? And they're going, we also have the ability to give accurate voting. And I'm going, you know, they go, well, we know you're against it. I go, you know what? That the first thing is, if you can make it where it's accurate and it's verifiable, well, then we can worry about whether the people really know what they're voting for. You know, then we can worry about all this other stuff. Well, we might not be happy. They might vote for the communist kind of whatever. I go, you know, I'm not really concerned. I mean, you know, the systems work or they don't work, and people are, you know, going to figure it out or they're not. But I want to have a accurate barometer of that. And I don't think we do. So until I'm convinced of that, just out of its accuracy, I'm not playing. You lost me before we even got started, because I don't trust them.
Yeah. Well, you know, we should remember, too, that voting is a necessary element of what some would call democracy, but I hasten to point out that we don't have a democracy and shouldn't want one. We have a republic. But in any event, democracy has no inherent virtue other than it's a way to make for political change without violence. But you can make change at the ballot box in ways that enslave you. There's no guarantee that simply having a say in your government that's going to give you good government. If people believe that they want government to get bigger and give them everything they want and regulate every producer in the country, well, they'll vote themselves right into slavery and bankruptcy. So there's no guarantee that you'll get good government or a healthy, prosperous, free society by having the right to vote. It all depends upon why you're voting and who you're voting for. And remember something that Mark Twain said. You know, he was not very happy with very many politicians. And after one of them that he particularly didn't like passed away, he had a great line. He said, "I didn't attend the funeral, but I sent a nice letter indicating that I approved of it." This was his way of saying, hey, a lot of these guys, you know, you're kind of glad to see them go one way or the other.
You know, I'm glad Fee's there, and it had such an impact that it would produce a quality individual like you to be, you know, head of it. And I certainly see that there's, you know, Fee has risen in awareness and stature, certainly in the last decade. And I'm thinking as we go further, your star shines a little bit brighter in the future too. I mean, what's the future look like for you guys?
Oh, we are so excited. Ernie, and I hope your listeners will visit our website and they'll see some of the reason why we're excited. We are setting records in everything that we do. Numbers of students who go through our programs, page views on our website, social media connections, I mean, you name it. We're going great guns. We may be one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing, market-friendly, personal liberty and personal character-focused organization in the country these days. And in the future, you're going to see a lot more on the website, more interactivity with young people, more young people getting engaged with us in one media or another, and more success stories of young people who've been inspired by us and then go on to make individual liberty and personal character very much a part of their lives in whatever professions they choose.
You know, that is a good connection. You know, the personal liberty and individual character. I mean, you know, to have someone even say, and, it, and in your name it helps, you know, the foundation for economic education. You know, what else do you do? Yeah, I need to do something else.
That kind of cures everything. Well, let me tell you. Since you've raised it, this connection between liberty and character is not only fairly unique with us, it's extraordinarily central to what we do. You can go to our website and type in, "Are we good enough for liberty?" And you'll go to a page where you can order a small book by that title, up to 20 copies free. We're making the message or passing it all along to audiences all over the country that liberty is indispensable to the promotion of character and vice versa. And until we solve the character problems in the country, we're not going to solve our economic problems.
I would add nothing to that. That is very, very, I'm glad you're there. Lawrence, hopefully you'll make yourself available in the future. As time goes on, we're going to have to get into the nitty-gritty of proposed policies as somebody give us an excuse to have you on, talk about stuff, and I'm just slapping around the entire system, and the solution's going to come from Generation Next with a little help from Foundation for Economic Education, FEE.org, and headed now by an individual that was in 1968 exposed to them and got sent on the right path after the Russians invade Czechoslovakia in the middle of all that was going on in the late 60s, and he found a thread that led to the truth, and now he's sharing it with Generation Next.
Since time began, tyrants have taken...
There we go.
Hey, thanks, Ernie. Wow, that went fast. And appreciate great questions, and hope you like the answers.
Yeah, no. It's just, you know, we just keep this going. See, the thing is I can we didn't even get to talk about your guys' move. We'll do that next time. But the I think we did the previous time we talked about it. But the fact that you're down there with, I mean, you know, the Mises Institute, you guys are overlapping a lot on stuff, you think?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and philosophy and economics. Absolutely.
You know, I had Walter Block on last week or week before, and I've had him on since like 03. And, you know, I enjoy Walter. He spoke at the Freedom Summit before. We get along fine. But he's definitely sucked into the election thing. You know, and government's going to, we need to have a say and talk and whatever and rant. And I'm going, you know, one, rant ain't his dad. I mean, that's the first thing right there. But the, he doesn't motivate. You know, it's just ew. You know, so I don't see that as the solution. Economic education, probably more. I can see where you guys would be, you know, rise up more than any one particular campaign. It may be a large net that would, gather some, individuals for you. You think?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, good luck. I hope so. Whatever we can do to help.